Hello, everybody, and welcome to Big Nerdy Questions, Episode 6. Now, tonight, I am so thrilled because we are finally going to be having an episode devoted entirely to my favorite nerd franchise of all, Star Trek. And taking me on this voyage to the stars, we have with me on the panel tonight, Josh P. Welcome back to the show, Josh.
Thank you. It's great to be here, sir.
Thank you very much. Specifically tonight, Star Trek is massive, but we just had a new movie come out, Star Trek Beyond. As of the recording, we haven't had a chance to see it yet, but also it hasn't had a chance to marinate yet in the cultural zeitgeist, if you will. So, excluding Star Trek Beyond, Josh and I are going to take a look at the Star Trek films, and our specific question is, simply, what is the best Star Trek film? We're going to assign at the end of the episode the gold, the silver, and the bronze. We'll see if we agree on which one are the best. But we are going to go through the films chronologically and analyze a little bit about each one. There's definitely plenty to say on all of them. Matt is our person who obtains sponsorships. He's not here tonight, so no one's sponsoring this episode. So, sorry, we don't have anyone to plug tonight. It feels kind of weird.
A little bit.
But we do have a big nerdy recommendation. I do certainly have one of those. In honor of Star Trek being my favorite series, I'm going to plug my favorite current author, who is Alistair Reynolds. He's an author from the UK, and he writes in the vein of space opera that's backed up by hard science. And I recommend every one of his books, but in particular tonight, I'm going to recommend Chasm City, which was published in 2001, and it won the 2002 British Science Fiction Association Award. It is a story that is a detective story, a dystopian story, a story about culture. There's so many things going on. Essentially, what you have is an advanced civilization called Yellowstone that has completely devolved into chaos because of a plague on machines and people that the melding plague essentially brings them together. It doesn't sound like the setup of a hard-boiled, hard-nosed noir novel in the style of The Maltese Falcon, but that's exactly what you get in space and on a foreign planet with some fantastic writing and dialogue. I cannot recommend Chasm City enough. If I could pick one book to be made into a movie or a miniseries, this is it. It is completely atmospheric, fantastic read. So please, everyone, check out Chasm City by Alistair Reynolds. So no feedback this week. We're still gathering feedback on our previous episodes, and we will be talking about it soon. But continue to send us your thoughts. Keep sending us your recipes for the hashtag Magneto Screwdriver, which, Josh, thank you very much for your submission in that contest.
You're welcome. And have you tried it yet?
I have not tried it yet. Matt is on it. He's on the task of finding the ingredients. I think it is now time to go into the films. And I'm thinking what we'll do is we'll talk about a pro and con of each film and see where that takes us, if that's okay with you.
Sounds great to me.
So we'll start at the beginning with A Voyage to the Motion Picture. By the way, we're going to not avoid spoilers here. We're obviously talking about Star Trek Beyond, but for the rest, we are going to be spoiling the hell out of these movies. So if there's one you haven't seen, try to skip ahead past it. Let's start with Voyage to Star Trek The Motion Picture. What are your thoughts about this space epic?
It definitely had that Stanley Kubrick artistic flair to it. It was at times very slow-moving, very trippy. And overall, it really was unlike any Star Trek experience I've ever seen.
I think that's fair. I think it's not like anything before or since. I mean, the humor of the series is gone. The colorfulness of the series is gone. I mean, the ship, I know whitewash can mean a lot of things, but it's literally been white and graywashed in the uniforms and the sets. It's just, it feels clinical in a way, but I do agree that it also has that Kubrick feel. I would venture to guess that Spock's journey into the heart of V'ger was directly inspired by the Star Baby sequence in 2001. I'm just guessing, but it has to be. I mean, there's so many similarities in it.
Yeah, certainly. I gotta say, and I agree with a coworker of mine that said this earlier, that the entire movie feels like 2001: A Star Trek Odyssey. So many similarities between the two.
Absolutely. I mean, the main antagonist is an artificial intelligence that's been corrupted because of its initial programming.
Right.
I mean, there you go. Now, an interesting fan theory I should point out here. A lot of fans have speculated that V'ger, the planet that V'ger visited that made it into V'ger as opposed to a probe, is actually the home planet of the Borg.
That is an interesting theory.
So there's, of course, been no confirmation on it. And it was considered highly implausible until the episode of Enterprise that established the Borg actually did come to Earth before Archer's time on the Enterprise. So the Borg has had interaction with humanity, and it's possible that that's how the V'ger's involved in some way, shape, or form. But it certainly establishes that they're closer than just the Delta Quadrant. And we know from the Voyager, the series, that hyperdrive, the specific kind of warp drive they use, can get them to Earth and back very quickly. So it is entirely possible that V'ger did visit some sort of Borg settlement. Although, to be fair, V'ger doesn't show signs of assimilation.
No, it definitely has its own consciousness.
Yeah, so I think there's some holes in the theory, but just one I wanted to point out. I think another interesting thing with the motion picture is this was actually intended to be a pilot for the second Star Trek series called Phase 2. And the initial characters, Ilea and Decker, were supposed to be the two main characters of Phase 2, with a few carryovers from the original series, but not many. More in the vein of Encounter at Farpoint, where the originals will show up to help turn the baton over. When it was decided to make it into a feature film, they decided to make, you know, Captain Kirk come in, take over the ship as Admiral Kirk. But that's why the framework is there for Decker to be the commander of the Enterprise. He was intended to be the main character of the series. And I think you kind of see that shoehorned in, because the relationships, as I said earlier, are just not there. You don't recognize the Bones, McCoy, or the McCoy-Spock-Kirk triangle relationship at all in this film.
Not at all. Also, they spent so much time showing Enterprise coming into port and taking off. If you edit all that out, you have about one 45-minute episode of TV right there.
Which probably makes sense. I mean, if you take out some of the more trippy sequences, you've got the length of a TV show. I will say there, you know, I want to say some pros. Obviously, it's the first one, so it set the example. So thank you for that. The visual effects are impressive for their time, especially the opening scene where you have entirely new Klingons for the first time with ridges being completely blown to bits by a cloud of lightning. The soundtrack for this movie, Jerry Goldsmith outdid himself. And I don't think it's an accident that the main theme from this movie was reused again in Star Trek V and became the main theme song for Star Trek The Next Generation.
Right.
So there's definitely some good here, but I think you're right to say that it doesn't feel like Star Trek.
Not at all. Not at all, in my opinion. And an interesting side note, when I was watching that movie to study up for this episode, I was hours removed from the operating bed at a LASIK eye facility. I just got LASIK surgery. And I just needed, my eyes were on fire, the numbing had worn off, and I just needed to sit down and watch something. So I was like, I can watch Star Trek. Most of it takes place either on a poorly lit bridge or in the vast blackness of space. Nothing there is going to hurt my eyes. Now, I had never seen the motion picture up to this point. So once I got in there, I had to watch the entire movie with sunglasses because it was literally hurting me to watch.
I think it may have hurt more people who didn't have LASIK, but for different reasons. But, wow. So, note to self, don't get LASIK and then watch the motion picture. Also, don't get LASIK and watch 2001. You're going to have a bad time.
They're literally painful to watch in that situation.
So, anything else you want to mention about the motion picture before we move on to something a little bit better?
I think my favorite scene from that movie was the wormhole scene, where everything's in slow motion and it's just so overdone.
It really is. Weapons firing now.
One.
And then, of course, you have the monotonous disclose the information.
Disclose Major the demands the information.
Oh, man. I think it might have been directed by a computer as well, but that's just... Sorry, Robert Wise. But this was not your masterpiece.
No, not at all.
But I think Nicholas Meyer may have had a masterpiece in The Wrath of Khan.
Yes.
What's your first thought on The Wrath of Khan?
I really like The Wrath of Khan. It is a good movie, but on a humorous note, my favorite thing about this movie is that it really, really shows just how bad of an actor William Shatner is. I mean, the two most iconic moments in that entire movie are William Shatner being a bad actor.
Do you want to give us an impression of either one of those scenes?
His was the most human.
I know that was one of the ones. I think the other one is a loud yell, right?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah, but that was the other one I was thinking of. Although, to be fair...
His facial expression and everything, everything about the way he yells, Khan, is just so overdone.
His overacting in the funeral scene actually works.
Yes.
In a strange way, it works.
Yeah.
Though I think that this movie is tailor-made for his bad acting because it's the film where Kirk faces his personal antagonist. I don't think there's any other storyline in the films that's as personal for Kirk, with maybe the exception of what happens to David in 3. But this one is cuts deep to the bone by design. And yes. I think the one thing you notice in this film, and you maybe don't notice it because of the way they constructed it so well, but Khan and Kirk are never in the same room in this movie. The only officer of the Enterprise that Khan interacts with face-to-face is Chekhov.
This is true.
It's entirely done ship-to-ship in a naval battle style. And the reason is, from what I've read, the filming schedule for Fantasy Island did not allow Ricardo Montalban to be on the set at the same time as the Enterprise crew. So they actually used the Enterprise bridge is also the bridge for the Reliant, just it did a refit.
Okay.
And I think to step ahead a bit, I don't think we can talk about Wrath of Khan and not go straight into Darkness.
That's fair.
Because, and then we're going to come back to it later, but Into Darkness is essentially a remake of this film. I mean, and one of the things that they emphasized in all their interviews, both J.J. Abrams as well as Zachary Quinto, Benedict Cumberbatch, they also they wanted to emphasize that their Khan interacts on a face-to-face level with the Enterprise crew. And they have the fist fight on the ship on Earth just for that reason, because they felt it was missing from Star Trek II.
Right.
I don't really think it's missing, though. I think Star Trek II doesn't need it. It's constructed well enough that you don't realize it's not there.
Agreed. And also, Khan would destroy Kirk in a fist fight.
Absolutely. It would be no contest. And he almost destroys him in a ship-to-ship fight. The only way he wins is because he knows more about Federation protocols than Khan.
True.
So it's insider trading that saves the day, in a manner of speaking, in this film. So we can go over some of the intangibles. The humor is back. The relationships are back. I think the Kobayashi Maru was one of the most iconic things for Kirk's character.
Yes. Especially the way that he allegedly solves the problem.
He cheats to win.
Yes.
I mean, if you're not cheating, you're not trying, right? At least that's Captain Kirk's methodology. And that's true both in ship-to-ship combat and relationships. And speaking of that, we have Carol Marcus in this movie. So I actually think she might be a weakness, and it's not her fault, not the actress's fault, but with so much going on, there really isn't enough attention given to this huge revelation that Kirk had a major relationship and a child.
Yeah. They just kind of glanced over that. It's like, hey, Kirk's got a kid. Oh, he's dead.
Yeah.
Sorry, we're not in episode 3 yet. Sorry.
No, I mean, everyone listening should know that. but you're right. I mean, it's kind of just thrown out there. Do you think that Carol Marcus and David are simply plot devices to make this more personal for Kirk? Or do you think that maybe their relationship got cut on the cutting room floor?
That is an excellent question. I really like the theory that they're plot devices just to make it more personal. I couldn't say definitively. I wouldn't bet money on either one of those two being true.
That's true. I wouldn't either. But it's just a little nitpick, because I do think it's an overall good film. One other thing I really like about this movie, I love the red uniforms that are put in place in this film that last through Undiscovered Country.
Oh, yes.
They are either my favorite or second favorite Trek film of all, period. They are fantastic, and they look sleek. I love the fact that they use actual medals and things to denote rank, which is much more accurate to the Navy. Obviously, it looks nothing like a formal naval uniform, but it puts you in the mind of a formal naval uniform because everyone's wearing the same thing.
It certainly looks more like a naval uniform than any other Star Trek uniform ever.
And I think that's a good thing. And Nicholas Meyer even said that he wanted the ship and the uniforms to appear more like they were a military vessel, which is why he did everybody has the same color, and the only difference in colors are the collars of the uniforms. White for command, Bones's collar is blue. I think the cadets have red collars because of Savick, but it's not explained in the movie. It's very subtle.
Right.
So what else do you think about Star Trek 2? Any other thoughts before we move on to 3?
Not really. I'm going over positives, negatives, and favorite quotes.
Well, yeah. One other thing I do want to mention real quick. When I first saw this movie, I was 6, I think. The bug scene scarred me.
Oh, yes. Oh, man, I couldn't watch that either. That was just intense.
God, I think that might be the most disgusting thing in all the Trek films. The only thing that even comes close in my mind is the piercing of Picard's eye in the First Contact introduction.
Oh, yeah.
But that, the bugs going into the ear, oh my God.
And they made that look so real, too.
Ugh.
And then they came back out later, too. Like that was even more hard to watch.
Yes, it was. This is not SETI Alpha 6. This is SETI Alpha 5! Yeah, this film is immensely quotable.
Oh, yeah.
There's no accent. Oh, well, and there's one thing we have to talk about. When this film comes up in pop culture, I have seen this film listed on a lot of lists as having one of the best death scenes in cinema. Not just in science fiction, in cinema, period. So what are your thoughts on the Spock sacrifice?
Oh, it still gives me goosebumps every time I see it. And I still choke up a little bit watching the funeral afterwards. Even though, you know, William Shatner does a humorously bad job delivering that last line. And then, of course, the way that Scotty plays Amazing Grace as is being, you know, launched out of the torpedo bay, it was also one of the most fantastic movie endings I've ever seen.
Absolutely. As a transition to our segue to Star Trek 3, they added in the hand on McCoy when he says, remember, that's not Leonard Nimoy's hand. He had wrapped up filming, and I don't know whose hand it is. It might have been Nicholas Meyer's. Leonard Nimoy held a beef for that scene for years because the fingers are not in the right place for a mind meld. And only he would notice this. But the scene was added way in post-production when they realized that by dumping Spock on the Genesis planet, we can bring him back. And there's our segue to that's Star Wars. This is Trek.
I've been saying the same thing.
To Star Trek 3, The Search for Spock. Now, people usually put 2, 3, and 4 together as the closest thing Trek has to a trilogy. But I think that each of these installments is very different.
Agreed.
I do think 3 is one of the strongest odd-numbered movies. And there are some things that stand out for 3. I love Christopher Lloyd as a Klingon villain. That's fantastic. Yeah. With a targ. That's fantastic. And a targ is the dog-like thing, for those of you who don't know Klingon biology.
I was going to say, Doc Brown's a Klingon! We got to go back, Morty!
We need some plutonium!
No. Oh, my goodness.
Oh boy, now we're seeing some interesting crossovers. But yeah, that's a fantastic scene. I have to say that one of the saddest scenes in the entire franchise happens in this movie, and it's not David Marcus's death. I think you know what I'm talking about.
I don't. I'm sorry.
It's okay. The destruction of the Enterprise.
Oh, okay.
I mean, yeah. She's a character in her own right. And you're right. The death of the Enterprise.
That was the first time the Enterprise got destroyed.
Yeah, because this is before TNG, before anything like that. Yeah, that was heavy. And even having watched TNG before that movie, I still didn't know what happened to the earlier Enterprises. And to see it go up like that, whew.
Yeah.
That's tough.
I honestly did not, I guess when I was watching it to study for this episode, I did not feel the weight of that the same way you did.
It happens. Everyone has a different thing they're attached to. I mean, I have a model Enterprise in here in B&Q headquarters, so I'm attached to that ship. So to see it go up in smoke, it's just, aw.
Yeah.
Not to say David Marcus's death wasn't sad. It was, but you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah. He died trying to save the Vulcan officer, right?
Yes, absolutely. And then Kirk gets sweet, sweet revenge using those old-school fight techniques from the series.
And by the way, can I just say, doesn't it feel like that fight scene between Kirk and the Klingon commander feel a lot like both Mufasa's death in The Lion King and Scar's death in The Lion King?
Yes, I agree with you completely. I think Disney ripped off Star Trek. But, you know, I'm sure we're going to hear about that one. But, you know, I agree with you. There are definitely parallels there. And in both the environment and the setting of the death, but also the whole Shakespeareanness, to quote a word of it all.
Scar looks like the Klingon. Scar is a Klingon.
That's our hashtag for the week, ladies and gentlemen. Hashtag Klingon Scar. So give us your Photoshops, ladies and gentlemen, of Scar as a Klingon. We want to see this. Pain sticks and all. We've been saying Klingon. This is the first time Klingons appear as the big bad in a movie.
This is true.
I know we saw them in the motion picture, but this is the first time they're a villain. And you could argue they're a villain in 6, but it's more complicated in 6.
It definitely is. Some Klingons are the villain in 6. Most Klingons are not. They are just they're just having a misunderstanding.
So I think 3 is really the only time we get the Klingons as the pure baddies in the whole movie franchise. Kind of in 5, but 5 is weird, and we'll get to that in a second.
And the Klingons in 3, they really ran with it. I mean, let's keep in mind, first to destroy the Enterprise.
Yes, the first to destroy the Enterprise, they kill Kirk's son. That's a pretty, you know, they did well. They did better than Khan.
Yes, they did.
Especially considering Spock's death was, oh no, that didn't happen. Ha 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 ha. No. He was the J.R. Ewing before Dallas.
Okay.
Who shot Spock? No,
Actually, that was Bobby Ewing that died and
oh,
then
thank
came
you.
Back.
Thank you very much. That was Bobby Ewing. Who shot J.R.? Bobby Ewing came back. You were right, sir.
And I'm very sad that I know that.
Thank you, Family Guy. That's where I know that from. But you're absolutely right. So what do you think is the biggest weakness of 3?
The biggest weakness of 3 is I don't know why they wouldn't have had support from the Federation going to go find one of the most prized officers, one of the most prized public servants Federation has ever had the honor to have in their ranks, for one.
I agree.
I don't know why they had to do that illegally.
I mean, I understand that it's entertaining to see Scotty sabotage the Excelsior, but I don't get that either. And maybe it was a whole thing to try to eventually get Kirk demoted back to captain. But sure. I feel like you're right. The Federation, I mean, we see them deploy ships, especially in the series, for some really mundane, boring things like, oh, look, this quasar is opening again for the first time in 5 years. Let's send the flagship. So if
every episode of Star Trek starts off, oh well, here we are, we're doing something boring. It's this day, and then something happens, and you know it always lasts for about 42 minutes, and then it goes away.
Sometimes
it gets continued into the next 42 minutes for some reason.
Unless you're on DS9, then it continues forever. But that's another show.
Yes, it is.
They couldn't have spared something. And if I recall, wasn't there a science vessel in the orbit of the Genesis planet already?
I believe there was.
Why couldn't they have hailed them and asked them, hey, by the way, during your surveys, go check out Spock's coffin. We have reason to believe it's empty.
Yeah, I don't know, man.
I mean, isn't Kirk an admiral? Doesn't he have the authority to hail them himself?
I would think so.
And be like, hey, I outrank you. Do a scan of this part of Genesis Planet. I don't have to tell you why.
It's a valid point.
So, plot hole.
Yeah.
Plot hole that's bigger than the one in 300.
Ooh.
This is Vulcan! Wow. So, anything else about 3 before we move on to the voyage home?
Covered all my talking points. Lion King and Christopher Lloyd. That was pretty much it for me.
So, basically, this is the homage to 80s and 90s cinema.
Oh my goodness, yes.
So let's go to the homage to 80s culture, The Voyage Home. And the very first thing I have to say is, where are the nuclear vessels?
Oh, of course. You got to bring in the vessels. Shout out to Matt, by the way. Matt wanted us to say that.
I'm here in Alameda. Where are the nuclear vessels?
I'm looking for nuclear vessels. Excuse me, nuclear vessels? Excuse me, I'm looking for the base of the nuclear vessels.
I mean,
how many times does he say that?
A lot, and I mean, okay, let's just be frank. The biggest pro of this film is it's funny as hell.
Yeah, well, it's a comedy.
It's a comedy. It is a comedy with Star Trek skin.
Yes.
They were using colorful metaphors. Transparent aluminum. Hello, computer. And yes, I'm talking to my mouse right now. Hello, computer.
Oh, so quotable. And of course, the best line in the entire movie. What, him? He's harmless. Back in the 60s, he was part of the free speech movement at Berkeley. I think he did a little too much LDS.
Oh, man. And, of course, a giant ship cloak landing in Golden Gate Park. Yeah, it's okay. No one's going to run into it. Everyone uses the sidewalks. Nobody jaywalks in San Francisco.
No one's going to look and see why some of the grass is squished down and about a foot lower than the rest of the ground.
Although to be fair, if it was some guy hanging out in Golden Gate Park in 1985 and he started saying that there were openings and giant men and whales going into a ship, they probably would have just chalked it up to the drugs.
Yeah.
So if they picked the right city to land in, although it would have been funnier if they landed in Chernobyl because they would have caused the thing.
Lord. There's so much to love about that movie. It's so funny.
Do you think it's true that this is the most accessible Star Trek movie for non-Trekkies?
Yeah, it's definitely the one that a non-Trekkie would most enjoy. In fact, I texted my mom before I started this, because my mom and I used to like watching Star Trek TV shows and movies together. And I asked her if she had a favorite, and she said, well, not really. It's been a while, and I can't really remember one from the other. But I did like the one where they went back in time and got a whale.
Yeah. My mom said the same thing. She said, the whales and Generations. So I think maybe this is the most popular film with mothers.
It's true.
Because they like doting upon whales? And if they remake this in the new series with the new actors, you've got to have Ellen DeGeneres as a character just so she can say, I speak whale.
Yes, that is an excellent idea.
I mean, just have her as a cameo. Oh, it's Lieutenant DeGeneres. It's our zoologist. It's Dory Merlin. No. Why not? Make it happen, powers that be.
Hashtag. I had one other point I was going to say. I completely forgot it because of that.
I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay.
Like the people of Earth forgot their duty to protect the whales?
Oh.
Burn.
They just did that.
Burn. So, maybe that is a weakness of this movie, aside from the ludicrousness of it all. What the hell is that probe thing? And where did it come from? And does this mean whales are sentient?
Kind of thought whales already were sentient.
More so than we even know.
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, these whales are like buddy-buddy with this thing. I mean, this thing came to Earth and was going to kill everybody because it missed its friend.
That's true. I gotta say though, I mean, it was a really neat theory, because I mean, do we still have any idea what is the significance of the humpback whale song?
No, we don't. Not that I know of. So it's a really interesting theory that they built this movie on. So there is some interesting science, interesting implications in this movie. So it's not just comedy, but it's a comedy.
And the humpback whale song itself is such an otherworldly sound, too.
Absolutely. And I would say, when this film came out, it might have been the first time a lot of people ever heard it.
It's quite possible.
So, but we have to mention one part of this film. In an upcoming episode, we're going to be discussing theories of time travel. This film has a unique one. If you take a Klingon bird of prey around the sun, you'll go back in time. I gotta chalk that up as a negative of this film, because what the hell? I mean, we can do that now with the probe, and it doesn't work.
I think it also had to reach a certain velocity.
That's
using
true.
The sun's gravity as a slingshot.
They had to use warp, so we can't do that. But it's still, I think they called back to the first film with the way they filmed the time travel scene. Very surreal.
Oh yeah.
I don't know if I'm a fan of the movie being set in the Klingon bird of prey. It's kind of dank and dusty compared to our beloved Enterprise, but I guess it makes sense in this film because the ship isn't the star. The star is San Francisco.
This is true. And George and Gracie.
Absolutely. There'll be whales here.
And it was actually very educational about whales, too.
It was. It really was. And I've actually taken to thinking of this movie as the prequel to Free Willy.
Wrong kind of whale, but sure.
Well, you know, rescuing whales from an aquarium, it's the same movie. Same movie. I think Free Willy would have been improved by a Klingon or two, but that's just me. And one of the things that sticks out to the movie from the very beginning is the computer repeating to Spock, "How do you feel? How do you feel?"
I do not understand the question.
Neither do I. But I think this film is partially an exploration of Spock trying to recapture his humanity through colorful metaphors. What better way to recapture your humanity than being thrust into 1986?
And knocking out that teenage punk on the bus.
Yes.
Just blasting his music and giving them the middle finger.
We haven't heard music that bad in a Star Trek film until the reboot from J.J. Abrams.
Oh, snap.
Oh, boy. I just got a lot of hate online for that one. So let's move on. Let's shift the hate to Star Trek V.
Plenty of hate to go around.
Officially the final frontier. But its real title is God's an Asshole, at least in this movie.
Well, it should be.
William Shatner is the director, and I probably can stop right there.
Yep.
By the way, Leonard Nimoy directed 3 and 4 and did a fantastic job.
Yes, he did.
Shatner directs 5, and oh my goodness.
Yeah. This is the one that starts when they're on shore leave, correct?
Correct. They're in Yosemite.
Yes, they're in Yosemite. And I remember the opening scene, you see it's very zoomed out, a small man climbing, free climbing a big rock. And I'm just sitting there, because I had never seen this movie up until I was watching it for this episode of B&Q. And I'm watching, and I'm like, who could that possibly be? Who is that? Oh, no. Is that... It's Kirk. Yeah. 50-something-year-old Kirk is free climbing the rocks at Yosemite. No, I paused it, I got up, I poured myself an adult beverage and sat back down because I knew I was going to need that to finish this movie. And holy Lord, was I right.
Oh my God, the planet of peace. By the way, Spock has a brother and he's a nut job. By the way, in the center of the universe, there's an omnipotent being that calls himself God that's really an ass. And by the way, Uhura is sexy as hell, apparently, and can distract an entire army.
Why did they make her do that?
Good God, how many things are weird in this movie. This is just... Yeah. Ugh. Why?
I really wanted this episode of B&Q to be sponsored by the Holy Church of Cybok.
It would have been. We'll have to have them sponsor us again. My goodness. This is such a strange aberration. I think this is as much out of character for Star Trek as the motion picture, but in a different way.
Oh, yes. A much less artistic kind of way.
I actually think the motion picture is probably a little bit... It is slower. It is stranger in parts. But the motion picture is extremely thought-provoking because it is so like a Kubrick film. Yes. I find the motion picture more redeemable than this.
I agree. I never said it was bad. You know, I made my joke about it being painful to watch because of LASIK surgery and everything, but you know, I did like it overall. I just wish it wasn't so slow.
I agree. This film, though...
And apparently you can destroy God with a single photon torpedo.
Who knew?
And you keep watching. Those Klingons are getting closer and closer. They're pursuing. They're going to attack the Enterprise at the worst possible time. And then it's just like, oh, no, we're not going to attack you.
The only quotable line of this entire movie is, what does God need with a starship?
Yeah.
Which, to be fair, is a hell of a line, but you got to question how you get there.
And then Spock repeating it, too.
And the ironic thing is, Star Trek usually tries to pride itself on its scientific accuracy relative to other franchises. It's not perfect, obviously. But they have science advisors on set for the movies, for the shows, that try to make it as accurate as possible. And they say in the center of the galaxy is where they find this guy. But there is nothing in the center of the galaxy, literally, because the center of the Milky Way... is a supermassive black hole. So the whole point of this movie falls apart.
Yes.
It's not even scientifically plausible. Beyond the whole God thing, there is a black hole where God, quote unquote, should be. So this fails on a number of fronts.
But let's try to find the little white dot on the yang side of the yin-yang. What is redeemable about this movie?
The opening scene at Yosemite, not the climb, but when they're at the camp, is a pretty good McCoy, Spock, Kirk scene.
Yeah, the singing Row, Row, Row Your Boat. I forgot about that.
Yeah, that's a pretty good scene for the three of them. I think today it would have been like a end credits shawarma kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's not bad. The idea of a peace planet that's just turned corrupt because none of the parties involved actually think it's useful could have been developed a lot better, I think. Because I think there's something to that, and we actually see that with the development of the neutral zone as a plot device in The Next Generation, and then the wormhole in Bajor in DS9 takes it even further. When you have the Federation, the Klingon Empire, the Cardassians, and the Dominion. So you have an idea there of how do these cultures promote peace when they don't trust each other.
Right.
But it's explored a lot better in 6.
Yes.
If they would have actually focused on that plot point.
Just the planet.
Just the planet. And if you're going to include Cybok, don't make him religious. Make his goal to take over that planet for whatever reason.
Make Cybok a Romulan.
Yeah, and make him want to take over that planet for the Romulan Empire. And they dispatch the Enterprise, and Kirk doesn't really believe in it because he's not a peaceful man. And he's got to fight for these people that are all corrupt officials. So you have kind of some flavor of insurrection there. It could have been a lot better if they do that. But right. Man, it goes off the rails.
Yeah, definitely not in my top three.
No, I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say that's not going to make our top three. So, moving on to 6, The Undiscovered Country. One of the classics, maybe?
Yes.
I, the more lists I see that have come out more recently actually place this as number 1, 2, or 3. We'll get there, but I think it's definitely getting some love from modern critics.
Yes, and for good reason.
Absolutely.
Very enjoyable.
As a historian of the Cold War, this might be the best depiction of the thawing of the Cold War and Gorbachev with the U.S. of any film ever. And it has nothing to do with the Soviet Union, per se.
Right.
I mean, what a way for the original cast to go out. I mean, you've got so many callbacks to the earlier movies where Kirk says he'd never trust Klingons because of what happened to his son. The theme of aging from Star Trek II comes back again in a much stronger way.
Right.
In fact, the character, the Vulcan female, and I'm blanking on her name right now, who's the one of the main antagonists, she's on the ship, the Enterprise, that was actually intended to be Savick, but they couldn't get either actress back to play her. And so they created a new character. So they were intentionally, and Nicholas Meyer came back for this. He directed 2, and he came back for 6. And you can see his influence again.
Yeah, and what's crazy about this movie, I was reading about this movie right before we started this episode, that whole script was a replacement for the original movie. It was a very, very quickly written script, and it was based on a suggestion from Leonard Nimoy on the concept of what would happen if all of a sudden peace started happening between the Federation and the Klingons. So, you know, as they would say, what happened if the wall came down?
Thank you, Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah.
This movie gave us so much that's so iconic. Chang as the Shakespearean Klingon, and the idea that Klingon is better in the Shakespeare is better in the Klingon, fantastic.
Oh, man.
What a performance.
Yes. What if he did battle with Picard, though?
I would love to see it. And both their actors are still around. Why don't we... Ladies and gentlemen, if BNQ gets big enough, we will invite Patrick Stewart and Christopher Plummer on this show because, let's be fair, it would be fantastic to see the two of them acted out. We don't have much time, ladies and gentlemen, but let's get it done. And there is a TNG connection in this movie. Michael Dorn shows up.
Yes.
In this movie.
Not a named character, but just a... defense attorney for Captain Kirk and Bones.
And apparently he is intended to be an ancestor of Worf's.
Oh.
I think the character was actually named Moog in the early draft, but they took it out because they didn't want it to be explicit.
Right.
But nice role for Michael Dorn. So I my only con for this movie, I'm not a huge fan of the pace the movie gets into when it gets to Rurapente. I think that the prison planet kind of slows it down. I much more like the political intrigue that's going on in the ship, that's going on before they go to the prison planet.
Yes.
I understand why they put that in there. It's an important part of the plot,
mm-hmm.
but it's my least favorite part of the plot.
Yeah, I agree. I do think that they got out of there pretty quickly overall, though.
Yeah. Although, to be fair, it's a great scene where they show, where they say, not every man keeps his genitals in the same place. He turns blue, literally.
Yes.
And here's my impression of that guy. Oh! Oh! Thud.
Oh, man.
Which, let's consider this for a brief minute. How does a species mate with the genitals and the knee? I mean, that's got to be...
Well, there are two main functioning parts to the male anatomy. Why are we getting into this, man?
No. It's just one of those things that when I watched it as a teenager, and that was where my mind went. So, anyway.
It's true.
But, yeah, Star Trek VI is fantastic. I love the cloaked ship as a solution. It's so obvious, yet so well done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a whodunit. I think it's a great Trek film.
Yeah, I agree.
So I think we're in agreement that Undiscovered Country is a modern classic.
Definitely.
So we're running short on time this week. So instead of going through all the movies, let's make this a to-be-continued for the first time in B&Q history, because Star Trek deserves two episodes. Take that.
Dun, 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 dun.
But we need some sort of closure, because we have to answer a question. So what's the best film of the original six? And we can obviously, we're going to talk about this a little more in our next episode when we give gold, silver, and bronze of the 12 we're going to cover. But of the first six, what's your favorite?
I would have to say it's The Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, I think The Wrath of Khan is my favorite too, although Undiscovered Country is close.
Certainly.
And Voyage Home is also close, but for a very different reason. But I think the Voyage Home comedy is well done, but I think the film, Star Trek II, stands up as a film itself.
Oh, absolutely.
Not just a Trek film, it is a good film.
Yes.
And I think we agree on the worst of the first six?
Five,
yeah, absolutely. It's not even a contest. That one's definitive, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, yeah.
So we usually kill Jar Jar, but he gets a reprieve tonight because it's a to-be-continued, so he can live a few more days. Will he die next episode? Spoiler alert, yes, he will. But it's okay. He's okay for now. But Josh will reconvene at a later date for our next part of this episode for Star Trek The Movies Part 2. But for now, and thank you to Josh P.
Not a problem, man. It's great to be here. I'm glad I get to come back and do it again now.
Of course, and thanks for myself, I guess. We will see you guys again next time on Big Nerdy Questions.